Soy.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Set aside the Mars rovers, the Mir station link-ups, the most pivotal moment in American space exploration came on that sultry night in late July 1969, with millions of us gathered in the glow of black and white TV screens, watching images broadcast from 240,000 miles away.
That's one small step for man.
Even back then, there were those who said it couldn't be done, or more to the point, that it had not been done. People who claimed the whole Apollo 11 landing was a juked-up Hollywood soundstage show designed to fool the people and assert American technological superiority over the Sputnik crowd. Right. Whatever. But 33 years later, the conspiracy people are still here, still asserting the hoax theory. And so, earlier this year, NASA's staff historian decided to commission a book, a factual rebuttal to all the claims of strange shadows, suspect moon dust, and a flag that ripples where there is no wind. But then, just a couple of weeks ago, NASA scrubbed its book mission. Connection listeners, what do we make of the fact that so long after the moon landing, those who claim it was a hoax still gather an audience? What is the best strategy? To engage them? To answer them, or to ignore them? And what does this ongoing debate say about our belief in technology, in government? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, as it turns out, the man who was originally hired to write the NASA Book of Rebuttals is going ahead with the project anyway. Jim Oberg spent over 20 years as a mission control specialist with NASA. He's also been a lead writer with the agency, and he's joining us on the program. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi, Dick.
Tell me why the NASA people said they wanted a book in the first place.
This was a project that I've been discussing with Roger Lonnie as the historian because of my fascination with the cultural impact of space activities and how people regarded both spaceflight and their whole world based on spaceflight. A lot of this culture was folklore. And although the NASA people, being engineers, were pretty surprised by it, if you look at human history, whenever we've gone on to new frontiers, whether it was Phoenicians or Vikings or off to the steppes of Central Asia, people always would see strange things and come back with strange stories or not believe the stories. And so these kinds of reactions to space are very, very human.
You're taking us back to the time when people argued whether or not the Earth was flat or round.
Or whether or not Marco Polo had really been to Cathay or not. They didn't believe his expedition to Cathay.
So, Jim, why did NASA finally decide against doing the book?
The doing it was something that Dr. Lonius wanted to do, but he was leaving. He was retiring. Set up a small contract to do what's called a monograph, which is a project that just writes on a single historical topic, and left. And then when news of the project got out, because I was doing some contact with various organizations and other and NASA centers describing the approach and the kind of help I'd be looking for.
Right.
And news got out. The new historian had no problem talking about it to the media. But then there was a great deal of, here's a book on this crackpot topic. You know, what's NASA either wasting their time on, or is it about time? There was plenty of controversy. Most of it was actually positive. A couple of snide comments by TV anchormen. And the NASA public affairs people figured it was just too much trouble to keep explaining that it's not a book to debunk the arguments or to engage the conspiracy theories. It's a book to say, what does the success or the limited success of these kinds of theories tell us about inadequate public knowledge about technology in general, space in particular, knowledge that people have got to be able to use as consumers, voters, educators, and that what we can do is use stories like this and other stories as indicators where public knowledge and discrimination powers aren't nearly as well developed as they should be. It wasn't so much a case of we're going to do a moon hoax debunking. We're going to do a book on education, and that's what I'm still going
to
do.
All right. Now, Jim, stay with me. I want to turn to another writer. This is a man who has published his own book. It's called NASA Mooned America. The title makes it pretty clear where Rene stands. Rene is outspoken among those who think that Apollo 11 never did land on the moon, and he's joining us from his home in New Jersey. Hi, Rene.
Hello. Dick, there's one thing that the people that are taking this apart are not conspirators. We don't know each other until after we're published or whatever. So the word conspirator is applied to anybody that criticizes the government who was in conspiracy if this is not true.
Well, no one's ever done that. You're making that up. No one's ever applied the word conspirator to you.
Well, sure you did.
I may have used it in the beginning of the program, but
okay.
Rene, let me, while
anyway,
I have you on the program, ask you if you can do something for me. Your case is supported with photos and with theory. And now, if I ask you to put your finger on the one most telling piece of evidence that you use to say that the whole Apollo 11 thing was nonsense, what do you point to?
Radiation in space. And that came later because the information has been so severely bottled up that it took me about 10 years to get the final proof.
I'm going to have to ask you for like a grade 3 explanation of this. I thought it was a case built on photos and things
like
that.
It was in the beginning. Have you read my book?
I haven't seen it, no.
Well, how can you possibly hope to do a book on this when I have the seminal book on this whole conspiracy scheme?
I've seen a lot of websites that actually make the same case that you do, you know? So
no, I'm sorry, you don't. What you see is a lot of plagiarism going on, and Bill Casing was the first. I did not plagiarize him. He did not obviously plagiarize me.
Rene, I'm asking you to make your case. I'm not asking you to defend your book. I'm just asking you to make your case, why it is that people should not believe it.
Fine. I'm going to regular phone. Okay? Am I clear?
I can hear you. I'm just wondering if you can make,
yes, I can.
Make the case for me.
Have you ever heard the name John H. Malden?
New to me.
Well, he was an ex-astrophysicist for NASA. He wrote a book called Prospects for Interstellar Travel. On page 225 of his book, we find these statements. Hang on while I get to them. Here we go. Whoops. Come on up, phone. This is a direct quotation. By comparison, solar flares can deliver GeV protons in the same energy range as most cosmic particles, but at much higher intensities. Increase of energy accounts for most of the increased radiation danger because of GeV protons or their products will penetrate several meters of material. Malden goes on to say that cosmic particles are dangerous, come from all sides, and require at least 2 meters of solid shielding around all living organisms. That's 2 meters of water. Now, he then states solar or star flares.
You've got to translate this for me, Rene. The language that you're reading doesn't mean anything to me.
Well, by God, it should, sir. I mean, you've been employed by NASA all these years.
No, wait, this is
a direct quote from an astrophysicist.
You're confused, Mr. Rene. You're confused again.
It's actually Dick Gordon, the host of the program, asking you to make sense of this for me.
Okay. We have not too good of shielding.
No, you don't have too good an idea of what's going on in the world.
Sir, you're either a NASA apologist and totally ignorant, or you're a liar. I'm here to determine which.
Who's the radiation belt? Who's the radiation belt named after? Who the radiation belt named
after? James Van Allen. I'm going.
And what does James Van Allen say about the danger of the radiation belt?
Okay, you want to jump past Malden? Fine. Here we go. James Van Allen in 1959 in the March issue of Scientific America on page 39. The title of the article is Radiation Belts Around the Earth. The subtitle is Instruments Borne Aloft by Artificial Satellites and Lunar
James
Probes.
James Van Allen says those theories are flaky, that you have to spend
James
30
Van Allen
days.
Okay, hang on.
30 days
both of
later.
You, Rene and James, it's Dick Gordon here. I want to try and stop the conversation at that point because you guys are arguing at a level that sort of leaves the rest of us a little bit in the dark. Rene, tell me, in your view, why it is that 33 years after July of 1969, the conversation about whether or not the Apollo 11 landing is still going on. I mean, the claim that it didn't happen. Why, in your view?
Something deadly wrong with NASA's picture of this. The first thing is James Van Allen very, very clearly stated in the beginning okay? In the beginning, that space was a sea of deadly radiation. He was hired by the government to find this out in the 50s. He had what he called raccoons shooting up there 1,000, 2,000 miles into these belts. And the first thing they found out was that the Geiger counters became overwhelmed and became continuously busy. This is another quote. At 30 miles up, continuously busy, the Geiger counters would keep going, click, 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 click. And from, what is the number?
Renee, I'm going to interrupt you here because I'd like to bring Phil Plait into the conversation. Phil's an astronomer at the Physics and Astronomy Department at Sonoma State University. And Phil, your book, Bad Astronomy, is and your website, badastronomy.com. This is part of what you do, is working with the argument over theory here. Is
that's
that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long road for this website. Mostly it's astronomy in general. But about a year ago, I picked up on this whole moon hoax nonsense stuff.
Okay, so we know where you're at. You think it's nonsense, right?
Yes, I do.
And so why does it continue in your view?
Well, there are certainly adamant proponents of it, as you can tell from Mr. Rene here. He's very adamant about his stance, and there are three other big names. He's mentioned one of them, Bill Kaysing, and there are a couple of others.
Right.
They are tireless in promoting this conspiracy theory, even though they have no evidence and the claims they make are, in fact, grossly wrong.
And Jim, in the book that you're still going ahead with, you talk about the cultural history of this
first,
debate.
First, of course, what we're seeing, we're looking at what. How does the public know? You know, Mr. Rene is doing a service in terms of creating arguments like this that people can. It's like you're testing a body's immune system by infections to see how it reacts. Does it know how to respond to crackpot theories? When it comes to radiation, for example, and this is really important. It's not just important for moon flight, but radiation is a technical issue that the public has. It's an issue of radioactive waste disposal. It's an issue of depleted uranium munition usage. It's an issue that's critical in many areas of public policy. And so it's an issue that when you see areas where it's being misrepresented or misunderstood, you recognize the need for, you know, for better education for more outreach. Dr. Van Allen, for all the quotations that are maybe 40 years old, Dr. Van Allen is the world expert on the radiation belts that bear his name, and he's quite adamant that his information is being distorted and deceptively used by people in the Apollo hoax story.
Which is something that I gather both of you, with books and websites, are attempting to try and address. Is that
well,
right?
I would like to, for example, go back to the original experts like Van Allen, see what they think, not what Mr. Rene would like you to believe they think, or by picking selective and for all we know, misquoted words from them. Van Allen has a letter he sends out to people, and even a few weeks, whenever teachers write to him about these shows they see, they ask Dr. Van Allen, and he says talks about radiation. He says, sure, a person who's in a cabin of a shuttle in the most intense region of the radiation belt would be subjected to a fatal dose of radiation in about a week.
Jim, let me stop you there. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join our conversation about the ongoing controversy over the claim that the Apollo 11 landing on the moon was a hoax. Why it is those things stay with us the way they do. Thanks to Renee for giving us an example of the theory behind that. Good to have you on the program. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about the persistence of the conversation, the hoax claim that the Apollo 11 landing never happened. And there was a subject of a Fox TV documentary and opinion polls about how many people believed that. And you can certainly put that in the same category of how many people believe that Elvis is still alive. But what's interesting about it is that for 33 years, NASA decided or concluded or believed that the best strategy was just not to have a strategy, not to even bother with the people who were claiming that it was all done on a Hollywood soundstage. And then, because the people kept coming back at them, NASA decided, you know, as a teaching aid, what we should do is put together a book just exploding all these theories. So NASA hired someone. His name's Jim Oberg. Asked him to write this in a book. But due to the bad publicity that came from that, NASA a couple of weeks ago decided that it would withdraw its funding for the project. Jim is, as he mentioned earlier on the program, going ahead with it anyway. And we also have with us Phil Plate. He's an astronomer at the Physics and Astronomy Department at Sonoma State University. And Connection listeners, we're not going to spend much of the rest of the program exploring the ideas and the theories that would lead to this, but in fact talking about it in at the same level that that Phil and Jim are, as a cultural phenomena, and whether or not the response to it that's being mooted around is a correct one. Phil Plate, let me go to you. Do you think NASA should have stuck to its guns and gone ahead with a book saying just how ridiculous some of the theories are?
That's a difficult question. I suppose in the end, yes, they should have stuck with this whole project and not worried about the publicity. I can understand why they were skittish about this and why they were afraid of bad publicity. NASA has had its share of bad publicity in the past 10 or 15 years. I mean, we all remember the Challenger explosion and the problem with Hubble's mirror and the Mars probes. And so when things like this happen, of course, it's headline news. Of course, when Hubble makes really important discoveries, it does make pretty pictures and those get on magazines, but you tend not to hear about it so much in the news. And there are important discoveries being made every day. And of course, that's just the way news media works. When something bad happens, it's going to be trumpeted a little more than when something good happens. So they're being a little nervous about it. I'm not surprised. I wonder if they should have funded this in the first place. Maybe it would have been better just to support Jim and thrown their weight behind his being able to get funding elsewhere. But I think once they started funding him, they probably should have stayed with it.
And Jim, you're as you say, going ahead with the book. Will it be a different book now that you're not taking money from NASA?
Well, Dick, yeah, and of course, as you're saying, the funding is still the issue, and I'm hoping there are educational foundations and groups that that we're approaching to complete the budget. We're still trying to redo the budget,
right,
and have not yet been paid anything by NASA, although they promised. It will be a different book because it'll first be a little bit longer. The monograph was only going to be about 25,000 words and pictures. It'll probably be at least twice that. And as you said, discuss the wider issue of public education and things about spaceflight that are still puzzling. Because let's not use the moon hoax belief or disbelief as a full criteria. A lot of people who do believe in the moon flights, who accept them as real,
right,
still do so for the wrong reasons. Because spaceflight is mysterious. It's magical. It's pretty miraculous, and people at NASA have very often cultivated this view of themselves as the smartest people on the planet, who and the miracle workers. This has been a handy public persona, but it's also occasionally led them down the path of some pretty serious decision mistakes, crashing Mars probes onto the planet and things like that. So the book will be wider. It will talk about not just the theories that are obviously crackpot, but also and that's a real word. It's in the dictionary, and it has real meaning and has real use in the English language, but also theories that are heretical and views that, although I may not be persuaded by them, I'm still sympathetic to people who are trying to make the case because they're trying to do so logically, and they appeal to real evidence, not made-up evidence or misinterpreted evidence.
All right, let's open up to calls if we can to West Allis, Wisconsin. Fred's calling in. Hi, Fred.
Hi. First, let me say straight out that I don't believe that there was a moon hoax, and I'm looking forward to reading Mr. Oberg's book. But the reason this kind of thing can go on is that NASA really stands for Never a Straight Answer. NASA has been used for almost its entire life as a cover for military projects. And they are absolutely the worst people to work with the Freedom of Information Act.
Have you tried some of this yourself, Fred, in terms of dealing with NASA?
Yes. I can tell you personally that they will do things like take two different requests, unstaple them, put them back together so they can intentionally misinterpret them. And they were actually caught with a special manual which told NASA employees how to illegally frustrate Freedom of Information Act requesters. And also, there was a very interesting incident with Senator Richard Lugar, which I won't go into here, but his staff caught NASA in a real nice lie.
So, Jim, how are you going to deal with getting the information?
It's really delicious to be called a NASA apologist when, in fact, NASA has put out press releases calling my own theories wacko on other cases. I've had stuff, severe criticism of their management decisions from time to time, with combined with a real respect for the technological achievements of the workers and the teams. Fred, I think, is sharing some frustration with FOIAs, and I've had the same experience in other areas. But the NASA manual he refers to was not a NASA manual. He's exaggerating. It was a memo written by legal counsel at Lewis Research Center in Ohio, asking, and he wrote it primarily to embarrass his boss, who asked for it. The lawyer, NASA lawyer, said that this is stupid. He was ordered to prepare it, and he wrote a memo saying, you know, use stick-ons and do this and that. And it was, and then he leaked the memo. So it's not a manual that NASA employees have. It's a letter written by one lawyer in NASA, Lewis. But it was designed to be provocative and controversial, and
sounds
it was.
Sounds like it worked. 1-800-423-8255. Fred, thanks for your call to Arlington, Massachusetts. And Andy Chaikin's joining us. Andy is the author of a book called A Man on the Moon. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine.
Very good. Well, I wanted to just weigh in here and share my own experience, which is that I spent 8 years riding a man on the moon, and in the course of that effort, I spent hundreds of hours, not exaggerating, interviewing all of the men save one who had been to the moon, 23 of the 24 moon voyagers who were alive when I started my project in 1985. And I also have had extensive experience with mission control people, scientists who analyzed the rocks, who trained the astronauts to explore the moon. And just for starters, I can tell you that not once have I ever experienced a shred of evidence that anyone was lying to me about the reality of the Apollo mission.
So what is your conclusion about why some of that persists?
Dick, I'm trying to puzzle it out over the last few years myself, and in fact I've worked with Phil Plate on having publishing an article about this. I think it has to do with the enduring estrangement that we have from technology. I think that when Apollo happened, it was basically something that most people found very difficult to understand and to fathom. One of the reasons I wrote my book was that I wanted to bridge that gap to the human experience of going to the moon. But I think that even now, three decades later and more, we find it very difficult to understand how it happened if we were not involved at the time or if we're not in the space program now.
So, Phil Plate, does that mean that we become vulnerable to suggestions of conspiracy?
Oh, certainly. Carl Sagan, in his book Demon-Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark, says that people who do not understand science will be in trouble, because there are going to be people who do understand the science and can use it against these other people. We, as a nation in the United States, every year have a less and less of an understanding of science. And it makes it very difficult sometimes to explain what is going on. When we teach science to kids, a lot of the times it is just memorization of facts. Water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. This man invented the telescope, this man invented the microscope, and here's when it happened. And what happens is the students are distanced from the actual process of science, which is a discovery process. And of course, kids from the ages of, 0 to 10 are natural scientists. They explore the world. They like to hang names on things. They like to see how things happen.
Yes.
I have a 6-year-old daughter who is fascinated by what's going on around her. She loves having me explain why things are going on.
Which part explains also why, when we had Rene on the program for a limited period of time, his attempt to make the case was to be or sound as scientific as possible, to be as persuasive,
well,
using that information?
That was a magician kind of thing. That's why science and magic tend to be mixed up in the public mind. Science and special effects, science and Hollywood.
Dick, let me say one thing here. which is that I think...
This is Andy, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, and I won't take up more of your time, we went to the moon in part because we had been absolutely shocked to be beaten in space by the Russians who launched the first satellite Sputnik and
right.
the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. And that triggered a national crisis. And at the center of that crisis was science education. And I feel that we are on the brink of an impending crisis if we don't wake up and understand that science literacy is one of the most important things that we need to address.
Andy, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Andy Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Arlington, Massachusetts, Jim's on the line. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Interesting show, given the lead-in news story, which was that 11% of American kids could not identify the U.S. on a map of the world. I think that NASA is missing an opportunity here to use this as a teaching tool as far as science education goes. I think the last speaker sort of spoke to that point as well. I think it's a fascinating case study for how the public reacts to issues of science and technology and forms their own conclusions.
So Jim, was the mistake that NASA made in casting, at least in part, the book as an opportunity to rebut some of the nonsense because that...
Well, NASA never really cast it that way, and that was part of the
problem. This is Jim speaking, right?
Yeah, this is Jim Oberg, the author. By the way, Jim, in Arlington, thanks a whole lot. His brother's kids go to school up there in Clarendon, and they get a real good education there, but it's we got to do some more outreach. The book always was a case of looking at the social background, the cultural background, and the educational needs. It was never conceived of as a point by point debunking, and that.
But it was going to be an opportunity to address some of that,
and
wasn't it?
And in fact, it'll address very many. It'll address, in fact, radiation is my first chapter. I'm glad that Mr. Rene mentioned that as his key piece there, because he's got it so totally wrong. But it's hard for the public to tell a difference. Look at the debates over nuclear waste repository in Nevada and debates about radiation levels and nuclear power. These are debates in which the technology is treated as magic.
Let me go back to Jim in Arlington and ask whether or not, you know, even raising the question of talking about the hoax gives those people credibility beyond what they have, or whether or not the smart thing to do is to hold it up, as Phil Plait does on his website, and pick it apart piece by piece.
I think that the healthy result is an open dialogue around these issues. I think one of your previous speakers mentioned how a virus can infect an organism, and it's up to the organism itself to sort of respond to that threat. I think knowledge in our country can be viewed that way. If somebody has a crackpot idea, let it loose, see how it flies. But we have to be smart enough and organized enough, and even brave enough to actually respond to that issue in a visible process.
Yeah, here, Jim here in Houston. I totally agree. And as educators, we know that the basic rule is there is no such thing as a stupid question. Every so-called stupid question is an opportunity, is a doorway of interest in the people who believe these things.
But let me go to Phil Plait on this, because Phil, you take the opportunity to challenge some of these conspiracy theorists and get attacked for doing it that way.
Yeah, I'm a NASA shill, as it turns out, according to many of these men. I'm busting here because I really want to address this issue. What Andy Chaikin said and what the last caller said is an education opportunity. That is exactly what this is. I mean, NASA's viewpoint all along has been to ignore this, and you don't ignore a flesh-eating bacteria because before you know it, you're going to have to amputate, and we don't want to do that in this case. You really want to pay attention to this because the cat is already out of the bag. One of the things
What do you mean the cat's out of the bag?
What I mean is that...
I mean, these guys have been around
maybe
for 33
years.
And what, you know.
The Schrodinger cat.
Yeah, maybe that's a bad phrase. What I mean is that this conspiracy theory exists, and even though it is completely wrong, and in many cases it's just ridiculously wrong, it can be packaged in such a way, as we saw on the Fox show last year, that it can be made believable. And what these conspiracy theorists do, what the Fox show did, is they wrap it in such a way that they don't give you all the information you need to really understand the situation. And so when you watch these shows, you go, huh, how can that be? And the answer is usually something very simple, but they don't give it to you, and they skip around subjects very quickly so that you can't make up your own mind. Now, I give invited lectures about the moon hoax, and one of my favorite audiences is composed of teachers. Teachers come to these talks. I've given this talk at the California Science Teacher Association and locally here at the Sonoma County Office of Education, and teachers come and they say, you know, my students came up to me last year after watching this Fox show, and they said, did you know the lunar landings never happened? And these teachers got on the web and they found my website and were able to show the students that, you know, these conspiracy theorists are in fact wrong. And the beauty of this is that, as Andy said, there was a crisis in science education in the 1960s. The NASA moon landings spurred a whole new generation of students to learn about science. And what's happening now is that with science being taught as a series of facts and figures, and we're not teaching the scientific process, then these students can fall prey to anybody like Mr. Rene, who claims to speak from authority.
And then radiation when Fox does a high program like they did, wasn't there also some poll that was done after that that actually indicated there was an increase in the number of people who believe that there may be some truth to it?
Well, there's a Zogby poll on that, and the numbers are varied in their subject interpretation. What was distressing to me about that, 6 or 8% people said that they thought it was a fake, but people say 6 or 8% of any poll will say anything. There are some population groups that are higher. African Americans were saying 20%, and I think that's an indication of estrangement there from government, which is a sign of trouble that needs to be addressed. So there are various.
I'd hate to know what the numbers are for the number of people who believe that Elvis is still alive. But Connection listeners, we continue this conversation about the NASA's first and second response to the moon hoax theorists. The first to say, "Well, let's put out a book and tell some of the facts," and then the decision to say, "No, maybe that's not such a good idea." 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about NASA's response to the ongoing persistent moon hoax theories. Part of it was to get behind a book, which NASA then decided that probably was not worth standing behind. And a couple of weeks ago they pulled the plug on their support. The book should go ahead. The author is James Oberg. He has 22 years behind him as a space engineer and mission control specialist with NASA, author of 10 different books on space-related topics. Also on the program with us today, Philip Plate, who's an astronomer at the Physics and Astronomy Department at Sonoma State University. He is author of Bad Astronomy, currently working on a NASA-sponsored public outreach program for a new satellite, and our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Nahant, Massachusetts. Now Dorothy's on the line. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. Thanks a lot for letting me share this little anecdote with you, and I think the issue that you're discussing is much wider than just whether we believe in a polar or not. I have children that are middle school age, and they went with their science teacher to see the Apollo 13 movie. And they came back very shaken emotionally and very impressed with the whole thing. And I asked them, did you understand what the problem was on the ship? And they kind of said, well, kind of. And I asked them, well, do you know what a fuel cell is? And they kind of said, no. And I asked them, well, do you know what hydrolysis is? And they kind of said, no. And I said, well, did the science teacher discuss this with you? And they said, no, not really. And, you know, I mean, it really opened my eyes up to the whole idea that our children don't really even understand how a simple motor works, or how a battery works, or why a light bulb turns on. It's the whole issue of technology and of...
Let me just go straight to Phil Plate on this. Dorothy, stay with me. Phil?
Thank you, Dick. Yeah, this is a very interesting aspect of this whole thing, and I keep harping on this because science education is one of the things we do here at the Physics and Astronomy Department here at Sonoma State University. My group actually has funding from NASA and from other sources to educate the public on astronomy and space science. Dan Golden, the last head of NASA, was very gung-ho on educating the public about science, and as a matter of fact, had a decree that every new project in NASA must have a certain percentage of its budget spent on education. And so with these new satellites that are going up in the next few years, my group, run by Lynn Kaminsky here, is using this funding to do classroom educational materials on such things as how motors work, why stars shine, how black holes work, all of these things which students need to understand. They need to get their hands on these experiments and see not just that, you know, electricity is generated this way and that way, but they have to feel it. They have to go through the process themselves. Because what's happening here, this moon hoax conspiracy is a microcosm of a bigger problem in conspiracy theories. You have people like Mr. Rene and Bart Sabrell and others who claim to speak from authority. They make statements. They say the radiation levels were too high. But they don't give people the information they need to figure this out. And so they also engender a distrust of government, which is a flame which hardly needs stoking in the people. Mm-hmm. And so they're sort of wrapping this pill around a generic distrust of government. It makes it easier for people to believe in these theories.
Let me go back to Dorothy, if I can. Dorothy,
okay, sure. I just want to steer a little bit away from astronomy and all this.
Before we do, Dorothy, just a question for you about the reaction of your kids to Apollo 13, which was largely a movie. I don't know. I'm going to get myself in trouble by saying they stuck to the actual truth of the story, because I'm not sure how closely they did, but it was based on an actual incident. I'm thinking, though, your kids go off to see, you know, Armageddon or Deep Impact, that are movies about great monstrous meteors or asteroids aiming for the Earth, and are likely to believe that they're as true as Apollo 13? Is that...
Oh, no. The children were moved by the movie because I think they understood that it was real, that, you know, that the stuff could have happened.
Gotcha.
I mean, they watched some horrendous shows about monsters, and they're perfectly well aware emotionally that this is just make-believe and a thrill. But here, I think they were affected emotionally because they understood there were real men there that were really trying to save their lives. And the technology, and understanding the technology, and their expertise with that technology allowed them to do that.
So you're saying get that into the schools,
but for a different reason, not for a reason that, you know, they need to understand astronomy or anything.
I
think the reason is because the technology now, you know, is the basis of our culture's survival, and it is also something that drives public policy, or at least it should, and particularly in the areas of energy. I don't think that, you know, I think the whole planet has to realize, and our children are really at the forefront of this, is that we're running out of energy, and the whole, you know, our whole culture is going to collapse unless we understand how the various energies are interconnected and can be converted one from another.
Dorothy, I'm gonna interrupt you, and thank you for your call. I want to move over and get some other people in on the program. 1-800-423-8255 to Brighton, Massachusetts. George is on the line. George?
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Hi.
I grew up and was educated in Russia. I attended Leningrad University. I was still a student, so it was, I forgot what year was that, 69 or 68.
Did you see the moon landing on television?
No, not on television. At that time, television was not so...
So widely dispersed in the Soviet Union.
I saw a film.
Yeah.
Someone came to visit the astronomy department of our school, and someone from America. And there was a very limited audience to who that film was shown. And I was lucky to be there. And I can tell you that at that time, no members of the astronomy department, no students, no graduate students, not even those members of the Communist Party who would be more than happy to catch Americans, you know, on doing something wrong. No one questioned that. Nobody had any slightest idea that it was all a hoax. It was all very real, and we couldn't see any, you know, flaws.
So the idea that it was a hoax was more of a sort of low-grade American notion than anything that actually had to do with the space race, George?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know, like, that idea never ever came to anyone's mind.
I'm so glad, George, that you called with the observation from the other side of the space race.
But you know what? I want to take this opportunity to make a comment on American education. I'm a former member of the Mathematics and Science Advisory Council with the Massachusetts Board of Education. My term just expired. And I know the situation pretty well. And it is disastrous. It is disastrous. So I would not be surprised if in a few years not only people would question landing on the moon, people would question much, much simpler things.
Jim, we keep coming back to this fertile ground that is left by a lack of education.
Lack of education and a lack of practice in filtering things out, because you can't just go authoritatively and either believe all these stories or disbelieve, because in any technological and scientific field, some of the crackpot stories do work out. But they do so based on evidence that can be verified. It's not that they all work out. Most of them don't. But once in a while, someone starts with an idea that looks ridiculous and turns out not to be. But you got to find those ideas and then judge them. And the public's got to be able to tell a lot of the difference as well. They need to practice. This kind of the moon hoax stuff is useful because, like with the Apollo 13 movie, when it got cold deep in space, even though the moon hoax stories say that the sun will burn up the astronauts if they're there on the moon, you can actually do this, do an experiment. I'm going to have in my book, and again, this is Jim who's doing the book, a lot of experiments that kids can do at the high school level to test out many of these assertions. They are checkable. They are verifiable on the lab table or at home.
All right, let's move on if we can. George, thanks for your call. And we're off to Durham, North Carolina. Angela's joining us. Hello, Angela.
Hi. I'd like to bring up part of the problem is the hypocrisy in the U.S. government. The Bush administration actively promotes discrediting the scientific community when it comes to global warming and the effects of industry on the environment. And the religious right is actively working to promote the teaching of creationism alongside of evolution. And the conservatives currently in power have politicized science, whether it's from environmental regulation to sex education or family planning.
And we got to cancel nuclear power, too, because it's dangerous?
And Angela, these are issues. What I'm saying is that the U.S. government actively promotes discrediting science. The U.S. government does not listen to its own scientists in terms of how to regulate
the
environment.
You've got
to
get Ralph Renee's phone number and go talk to Ralph.
Hang on a second. Whoa, Jim.
The U.S. government is actively creating the problem that now they are complaining about.
But, Dorothy, isn't it always the case that when you have issues like global warming or places where there is actually a debate within the scientific community, perhaps less so now than there was.
Global warming is quite small. The debate in the scientific community about the effects of putting PCBs into our water is not really a scientific debate. It's a political debate.
Right.
So the government is being completely hypocritical to say, oh, now they don't believe us. They're not taking us at face value. Of course, I believe the moon landing occurred, but I think it's complete hypocrisy for the U.S. government to say the problem is the stupidity of the American people when we don't teach sex education, when we're trying to get creationism taught alongside evolution. It's a problem that they've created themselves. We won't sign the Kyoto Accords. We're stacking our regulatory agencies with people from industry.
Phil Plait, let's hear from you on the way that government policy also enters into this.
Well, I've never heard the government blame this on the stupidity of the American people. And as a matter of fact, I haven't heard the government say much about this in general. Science is politicized, of course, because science is important. This is the point I've been making all along. In something like global warming, you have a trend over centuries, which is difficult to monitor, difficult to measure. And in the end, the results may not be so obvious. I mean, it's pretty rare in science to have something where you can say, this is true and this is not. Ironically, the conspiracy theory about the moon landings is one of these things where we can say pretty confidently, this is not true. The landings did happen. I mean, the conspiracy theory is not true. And so in a lot of issues of political importance, the evidence is subtle, like evolution. The evidence is not easy to explain. It's not a soundbite. The creationists can make a statement, and you don't even want to get me started on creationism because that has a huge impact.
I don't want to get anybody started on creationism point in the program. But
it's science is typically not soundbiteable, and it's one of these things where you can say a fool can say something in 1 minute that takes 20 minutes for a scientist to debunk, and that's just the way things are. And with a short attention span in the news and in classrooms where there's not much time, it can be difficult to explain how science works.
So, Jim Oberg, does it mean that you set yourself up as a target by taking on the hoax people?
I'm sorry, setting myself up as a target?
Yeah, for them.
I imagine I am, because a lot of it is very personal, when you hear phrases like liar and stooge and apologist and shill, these are words used by propagandists. And I think as an art form, you can even appreciate some of the propaganda out there. And some of the films I've seen about the moon hoax are the best piece of slick propaganda since Triumph of the Will. They are very well done, very well crafted, and I don't think accidentally.
If the technology that the people who push the hoax idea have becomes more sophisticated, then does it naturally follow, Phil, that organizations like NASA also need to be a little bit more sophisticated in putting their stuff on the table for people, for school children, for everybody?
I think so. NASA's take all along has been to ignore this. And as a matter of fact, when I was researching it for a chapter in my book about a year ago, I was running into a lot of problems. I talked to a former astronaut. I talked to Professor Van Allen, who's at the University of Iowa. And initially, these people didn't want to talk to me because, you know, when astronauts get ambushed by people like Bart Sobrel, you know, most of your listeners probably remember when Bart Sobrel was punched by Buzz Aldrin in September for accosting him. You know, there's an attitude of alienation going on here, and it can be hard to counter these sort of things. And I agree with Jim. I get hate mail, emails from people calling me a spook and a shill and an ass a liar and all these things, which is just ridiculous. All I'm trying to do is to show everybody all of the evidence and say, look, this is what's going on. These other people are the ones who are actually lying to you, or at least not giving you all of this evidence.
Phil,
what I'm
for
trying
being
to promote
us.
Is critical thinking, and that's the key to this whole thing.
We've got to go. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Phil Plait, astronomer and author of Bad Astronomy. James Oberg, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dick.
James is an aerospace engineer, NASA contractor, and author. And earlier in the program, we talked to someone called Renee, who's a hoax theorist and author of a book, NASA Mooned America. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WB.